Thank you for coming to event 27 of Ledbury Poetry Festival. To start, I'd like to show our appreciation to the Arts Council England and thank them sincerely for sponsoring this event and continuing to support the festival as a whole. This event will be divided equally between the three poets, Choman Hardy, James Sheard and Andrew Nafis Saheli. I will introduce them in the order of their readings. First to read is James Sheard. Poet James Sheard is the author of Hotel Mastbosch in 2003, Scattering Eva 2005, and Damned Tour 2010, and his new collection, The Abandoned Settlements 2017. When away from his writing desk, he assists emergency poet Deborah Almer as poetic medic, ambulance driver, and dispenser of poem setamols. Jim's work has received the ICTAS Prize and been named Poetry Book Society's Pamphlet Choice, as well as the Poetry Book Society recommendation. It has also been shortlisted for both the Forward Prize for Best First Collection and the Glenn Dimplix Award for Poetry. He is currently in his 11th year of teaching at Keele University. Second to read is Choman Hardy. Choman was born in Kurdistan and lived in Iraq and Iran before seeking asylum in the UK in 1993. Choma has published collections of poetry in Kurdish and English. Her first English collection, Life for Us, was published by Blood Axe Books in 2004. Her latest English collection, Considering the Women, a Poetry Society recommendation, was shortlisted for the Forward Prize for Best Collection 2016. As well as poet, Choma is a scholar who, following postdoctoral research about women survivors of genocide in Kurdistan, Iraq, had a book published in 2011, Gendered Experiences of Genocide, Anfal Survivors in Kurdistan, Iraq. In 2014, Choman moved back to her home city of Soleimani and took up a post at the American University of Iraq, becoming chair of the Department of English in 2015. And third to read is Andre Nafis Saheli, who was born in Venice to an Iranian father and an Italian mother, but raised in Abu Dhabi. His non-fiction writing has appeared in a wide variety of journals and newspapers worldwide. He's translated over 20 titles of fiction and poetry from the Italian and the French, and his poems and translations have been featured in several anthologies. The Promised Land, Poems from My Itinerant Life, is his debut collection of poetry. His work will also be featured in a forthcoming volume of the Penguin Modern Poet series. So please welcome, first to read, James Sheard.
Hello. Thank you very much, Margaret. Lovely introduction, and in my section, all downhill for a while, and then back up again, hopefully. I guess that seeing the three poets who are reading together here today, there's going to be poems about exile and about movement and about all sorts of things connected with that. And I was looking through my work and thinking, yes, I do write quite a lot about that in some sort of psychological or emotional sense. I was born in Cyprus, and for the first couple of years of my life, I lived in a place called Varosha, which is part of Famagusta in the north. And it was abandoned in 1974 after the Turkish invasion and has never been resettled. We'll return to Varosha right at the end of my reading. But first, I'd like to read a poem which is an imagined postcard to my father when I made a visit there some years ago, trying to describe to him a place he loved very much, actually, describe to him what it was like now. Postcard from Famagusta. Haloed still, the saints' purged faces, still raimented, if that's the word, for colours draining down the walls towards the rubble, weeds and turds. Map-marked still, the streets you named me, yes, still extant, if that's the term, for pock-marked hulks of wired-off houses where rats and sentries take their turns. That jetty's there, the one you swam from. It still strides out, if that's the phrase, for broken pilings stripped of planking within the watchtower's arc and range. The hill roads open. The uplands offer cool relief, if that's the point. of all this earth art smeared on hillsides, flags and slogans, threats and taunts. My father died some years ago, and like a lot of men, he had a shed. And there's a holy duty, I think, of sons to clear out their father's sheds. He had done it for his father as well. And when doing so, I found myself remembering those terrible moments of standing around being an unpaid assistant whilst he did things, and that resentment that you felt about such things. Here's a poem about clearing out my father's shed. It's called Cargo Cult. In an imperfect incense of soil and old candles, the kept objects sit on split grey shelving, dull cones of lead, broken tools, bits of strange bracketry. For a while I fake the slim-fingered expertise of a collector turning porcelain, before letting my square hands hang and rust. Tumbled here like cargo from the metal perfection of a distant father, pinning me between fool and acolyte, between turning and waiting a quiet, unscowling moment longer for him to return and tell me what these things were and why it was they mattered. One thing I found when I was looking through some earlier poems was how often they were about people running away from things. And my partner Deb has encouraged me to read this poem, which she both likes but also thinks that it's an example of my, as she puts it, ponciness as a poet. In fact, she uses it in classes, in workshops, about how, you know, sometimes choosing the right poetic word is, not quite a good idea. She always laughs at this poem, but you told me to read it, so I'm going to read it. It's about after the gunpowder plot conspiracy. The conspirators had to flee. They fled towards the northwest. Some of them got away for a while, but eventually none of them did. And it's called The Lost Testimony of R. Catesby. The night had that distant glitter of Marcasset. We rode northwest, steaming off our chain of horses. I fumbled largesse at the way stations, struck fresh reins from the nervous hands of ostlers. It seemed the turf peeled back and the bones of recusant England tore loose beneath us. We had left women to watch the hurdles and quartering tables, ravel up the tawdry miracles of the scaffold side. Lips might twitch in a held-up head, blood shape a face on a corn husk. They slammed the fact of reformation shut on Guido's hands. Those thick fingers cut tapers, drew maps, bent barrel hoops an extra inch. He told me once we had lived too long as spiders in the curtains. Now I think of his strength decaying like dead powder, of dim ships slipping back into Biscay fog, carrying their sour cargo of questions and instruments. Can you enjoy that? I have an interest in, like many, many people here probably do, in literary translation, particularly the translation of poetry, and I think it comes from being 17 or 18 and going to second-hand bookshops and finding those wonderful anthologies that you used to be able to buy, you know, an anthology of African verse or, an anthology of post-war Japanese poetry. And you'd read these poems, and they were in many ways utterly baffling but also deeply poetic. And you had this sense that there was a poem which was the original poem, and then there was this thing which was also a poem, and it had many poetic qualities and obviously had the shadow and the bones of the original, but somehow had been transmuted into something rather wonderful of its own. I dabble occasionally in translation myself, and I'm not very good at it, but I found myself imagining a figure, a literary translator, I thought I'd write a poem about him, and I began to realise that the image I had of them, of him, was of a slightly creepy serial killer who just wanted to find some love. And here he is, the translator. Some people imagine that I find her creamy and clear-skinned upon her pages, that she arranges herself for me just so, that I can gather her up and place her where she needs to be. But she lies in a language, and language lies in a wrecking yard. I stalk and haunt its strange symmetries, its twisted piles, its interlocks and parabolas. I tug out her severed foot, her three fingers. I look for her torso. I need false plates for my refrigerator truck. Sometimes, and late, I call her. And if my mouth is moved to speak, it says this: let us buy bread and wine. Let your bread be my bread. Let your wine be my wine. Let us place them in a bag which is both your bag and mine. Let us carry them to a home which is a home I know. Let your table be my table. Let your people be mine. I'm sorry to all the literary translators in the room about the whole cutting up dead bodies thing, but there you go. There's a saying that poets don't drive. I've noticed recently there's a greater percentage of poets who do actually drive and have cars. We spend a lot of time in trains and train stations. Here's a poem about a train station, one in Hamburg called Dammtor, where I used to often find myself at 1 o'clock in the morning with no money and slightly sweaty socks. Dammtor comes a bit late in the poem. Dammtor. It's May, you thought, and after rain. White hawthorn had taken the tracksides. And no matter where we dig, you thought, we find a tilted land on a tipped earth. It's soft, you thought, the long grey scar of vanished rails. Something in your pack sounded like hoofbeats. Poor luggage lay piled on the gravel. You thought of how Dammtor was a station for midnights, hitched up on stone legs, hollow with sunken light, with the swallowed plosives of church space. You thought of places to be broken, too late to go home from, places to watch a welder in the high girders, his flaring iris hissing shut, yours stuck open. I drive now, so I don't need to travel on trains anymore. Along with thinking about the ways in which poets often write about being in motion or being still and trying to find some sort of way of how what they might do when they're in those places. I have a poem here which is called Beth Gellert, about a place in Snowdonia, but it's essentially about silence, of the wonderful feeling of sometimes falling quiet, which frankly we all need to do a bit more of, especially writers. Sorry, that sounded a bit aggressive, that, didn't it? Sorry about that. There's a poem about falling quiet. Beth Gellert. Cleanse these tricky instruments of mine, my hands and tongue. Let them settle still and pale. And let me play the sleepy priest who speaks no word till listening's done. Yes, cleanse these instruments of mine, my hands and tongue. And let me sit as cool and dumb as three stones on a dusty sill, or drift aloft like lazy smoke seeping from an unwatched hill. I'd like to read some poems now from The Abandoned Settlements, which is the current collection I have out. I know you can't see it, but I absolutely love the cover. I had bad experience in my last cover. This is wonderful. It's a flaky painted wall with a very old Bakelite light switch on it. And we were really pleased with it until somebody pointed out that the light switch looks a bit like a sloth's face. And from then on, you can never unsee it. And suddenly the serious cover becomes something slightly comic. The book is about the idea of abandoned settlements, places and people we leave behind, and the ways in which we try to, sometimes we find ourselves wanting to haunt those places again. That's quite a common thing for a bald male poet in his 50s to write about, frankly. We all get to a time when we spend our lives looking out of windows into the night and thinking, I wonder what happened to that sort of thing. A lot of the poems are about that, but they're also about place. The first one I want to read is called Cardamom, and it's a bit of a sort of presiding spirit of the collection in some ways. Bald 54-year-old man looking out of a window at night, essentially. Cardamom. Me, I'm in a place that once mattered, but no longer matters. And I figure, since it's late, that you're hungering for something that is like bread, but is not bread. That outside, there's the open weave of the wind, that there's the night and its usual practices. And I imagine that you've been reading, but it's the sort of reading that feels like inhaling rain. So you step out, and your shadow is lying long on the lawn. The flint of you is sparking, and bits of you are flying upwards, lodging in the night's lung. Yes, I'm in one of those places that once mattered, but no longer matter. Perhaps the alley bar at our back table, its scratches since sanded off, and its surface newly varnished. Or the dry bowl of earth beneath a weeping willow, where we waited for the cold and marvelled when it came. And we know, you and I, that there are some losses, which are nothing more than a train slipping on an incline in icy weather. And that there are those which derail everything, blowing a hole in the house wall and leaving the wind to howl around an empty chair. So I'm in a place that once mattered, but no longer matters, and I'm not granted the space and time to sing you back. But I wondered if you too are biting down on me now, biting down, as if on a split and softened pod of cardamom, on that bitter perfume, on that medicinal heat. My partner Deb has often pointed out that some of the poems in here are a bit creepy, in the sense that because there's an element of haunting the past back rather than allowing the past to haunt you, it sounds a little bit like the speaker of the poem is hanging around in the corners of rooms of people with whom he no longer has any contact and watching them. Yeah, I said that in a particularly creepy way just to sort of emphasise it. And she's right, there are a number of poems which are like that, and here's one of them. It's called White Roses. Well, I know what it's like. You have been walking your room, sniffing at your white roses and shivering. There is a sip of almond liquor in a glass on your desk and a note. You are aware of your heartbeat and your hands shake so that your cigarette arrives clumsily at your lips. How you hate it, the black glistening night, the programmatic blah blah of love and its attendants. Oh, you have been reading The Sense of an Ending. You have made some notes. This poem was written after after a trip to Spain, which is not really apparent in any way in the poem at all. But I think otherwise it tells its story. It's called Landings. We wanted a land where we could watch the weather, see how one hill drew down the drapes of rain and how another would flash its skin in a fall of sunlight. We wanted a land where the roads barreled straight over high, dry plains, the soil cooled to the frost point. It would stir in our drag, but show no sign of our passing. At night, we said, we would drink peach nectar, and we would seem to taste it all the way down, from its fur right into its ragged stone. And then, asleep, one of us would dream a line so sad and sweet it would fuck us up forever, as if we could be so again, and if such words had ever pulled clear from the fog of waiting and forgetting. Yes, we wanted a land where we might fall together, then fail to wake, or at least to sleep beyond the nag of morning, dragging us to its terraces and its coffee and tobacco taken slow and strong, to where every distant view was wrong. It's traditional for me to include a love poem to Deb when she's in the audience. Obviously, I do it when you're not there as well. Or do I? In the past, it's been it's fun to put in ones which are slightly comic, but I'm not going to on this occasion. This is a poem called Late. You could be my garden, for think how gardens can be our last and best love, our late love, brought up and out of our earth and made to bloom. Think of how we bring to them our lifetime of care, our longing for a place to lie in and call our own. That is why I brought you here in late summer, to watch you walk up through the blown grasses and their feathery tops moving gently around you. You came to me, slowly, down the long shade of the laburnum arch, as if approaching shyly from the long years of my early and middle life. Dappled and distant, but coming on, coming on. I'm going to finish with the title poem from this collection. As I say, the collection is originally, when I started writing it, I imagined, because I'm fascinated by abandoned settlements, as many people are, you know, those amazing places which for one reason or another have just ceased to be, you know, have people in them. And I imagined that at some point I would write a number of poems which were about place, and there are one or two which are in here, but essentially the idea of the abandoned settlements became much more metaphorical than literal. So when I came to write the title poem, which was right at the end, I thought I'd better cram some of those place names in here. So there are lots of place names in this poem, but they are only names of abandoned settlements. That's all you need to know. One of which is Varosha, where I lived as a baby. The abandoned settlements. Think of it like this. The spine you once caressed is the bony turf at Warham, the only thing left of the walls that held you, the hearth that warmed you. And there are still lights, they say, in a back room, in Miaulis Street, Varosha, somewhere inside, beyond the bleached doorframe and hinge splintered by decades of wind. It's like that. It's like the sands where once you might have watched a lover coming wet and lovely towards you, undisturbed now and colonized by the shyest of creatures. It's the lone tower at Wilmersdonk, its bell gone and the church it served now flattened, its weeded roof level with the crane tops and high above the hollow bangs of containers setting down. It's the wiped out and the martyred. It's the places struck from all your maps, the signs torn down and the roads to nowhere blocked for good measure. It's Oradour and Wittenoom and all the rust and rubble fall, the hulks and helplessness, the townscapes like a dead flat tire. Think of how it twitches in our backbone, is seen dimly through the window at night, how it walks towards us in a stranger's body, how it sets itself in high memorial above the utter transformation of our lives. Love, that is, for love exists and then is ruined and then persists. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, James. And now please welcome Choman Hardy.
Hi. I'm going to start with two poems from my first book, and then I'll start get into the second. I start with this poem, At the Border 1979, which is on the English GCSE syllabus, by the way. If you have children, tell them. And I like this poem very much because I guess I was 5 years old when my family had to move back from Iran to Iraq, because when I was born, they fled the country. And then there was an amnesty when I was 5 and we returned. So before I returned, I heard so many stories about homeland and how beautiful and fantastic. And then right at the border, there was a chain separating Iran and Iraq, obviously, the same mountains, the same landscape. I was very much disappointed. And I guess I learned the first lesson in my life, and that's much of what immigrants say about their homelands is lies and myths, you know, because you only remember the good bits. And children are the first to point them out, these lies and myths. At the border, 1979. It's your last checking point in this country. We grabbed a drink. Soon, everything would taste different. The land under our feet continued, divided by a thick iron chain. My sister put her leg across it. Look over here, she said to us. My right leg is in this country and my left leg in the other. The border guards told her off. My mother said, we are going home. She said that the roads are much cleaner, the landscape is more beautiful, and people are much kinder back home. Dozens of families waited in the rain. I can inhale home, somebody said. Now our mothers were crying. I was 5 years old, standing by the checking point, comparing both sides of the border. The autumn soil continued on the other side with the same color, the same texture. It rained on both sides of the chain. We waited while our papers were checked, our faces thoroughly inspected. Then the chain was removed to let us through. A man bent down and kissed his muddy homeland, and the same chain of mountains encompassed all of us. The second poem, which is actually the title poem of the first book, it's called Life for Us, not US. And this is about my first experience in the water when I was about 11 or 12. Now, in the Middle East, if you are a boy, you can always undress and jump into a river or a pool, but if you're a girl, it's a different story, and I never learned how to swim until about 10 years ago. It took me 20 lessons to be able to float. And so I gave this poem to my swimming instructor, who was very frustrated with me. I said, maybe you will understand. Life for us. In Qalachualan, in a holiday cottage with a courtyard and a large swimming pool, we watched the men undress, dive into the water, get out, drink a glass of cold beer, have a few spoons of beans and salad, then dive in again, making enormous splashes as they swam. And we, fully dressed in the hot summer afternoon, could tuck up our dresses and dangle our feet in the water. My male cousins, as young as I was, kept arguing that being a boy is better than being a girl. Doesn't swimming prove this? The liquid round my ankles seduced me. Fully dressed, I jumped in the pool and held on to the slippery bars. I loved the gentle embrace of water, reducing the warmth of the sun. It must have felt the same inside my mother, simple and relaxing. I became braver, let go of the bar, but the next moment I was drowning, my colorful clothes holding me down. But for a slight second as I plummeted, I saw my clothes spreading out like petals, opening up in all directions. Now, I'm so sorry, I'm going to spoil the party and read some very dark poems. That's what I do best. And this series of poems, it's at the heart of my second collection. It's called the Anfal Sequence. Anfal was a genocide campaign committed by the former Ba'ath state against the Kurdish countryside. It involved 281 gas attacks and mass graves, and 100,000 people were ended up in mass graves, and over 2,000 villages were destroyed. Now, I got a scholarship from the Leverhulme to do my postdoc research on women survivors' experiences. And obviously, being from the community, I just thought, I know this story. I'm very well prepared. Nothing will surprise me. And I launched into this very naively. So the sequence starts with the voice of the researcher, completely matter-of-fact and naive, and it ends with the voice of researcher 11 stories later when she's nearly breaking down or broken down already. So I'll read the first one and a series of survivor voices, and then I'll end with the researcher's voice again. Preface, researcher's speech. I have come to learn about your pain. Fill me up with your words. I have not been gassed nor imprisoned. Not mothered children to watch them starve or wither away. Don't know what widowhood feels like. I have not lived in a shack, nor worked hard in fields and factories to bring food back. I want to document your pain. Make sure your voice is heard. I cannot promise redress or direct help, but I promise to listen with all that I have, stay true to your story, not distort or edit your grief. I will write a book, try to bring you acknowledgement. So let's begin. Tell me about your life. Now, upon arrest, the civilians went through a series of selections. The men and teenage boys were immediately taken to be shot. The women and children were taken to special camps, and some of them were also transported to mass graves. And the elderly were sent to the border of Saudi Arabia, where many of them starved to death or died of illness. So this woman, the story of this woman, Nabat Fayaq Rahman, is on my website, the full transcript. And while she was telling me the story, she kept saying, "You do not die." And this was the beginning. This is how the poem began. So this is called Dibis Camp, the woman's prison. You do not die, not when you want to, not when you see your strong husband, the big brother in his own family, kicked bloody by a group of men equipped with loaded guns and hatred. Not when your beautiful teenage daughter is handpicked by soldiers, never comes back, and for the rest of your life you are left to wonder, was she sold to prostitution? Does she still live? Not when your son withers in your lap and you cry, and he cries until he can no more, when the last thing he asks of you is cucumber, and you give him a green slipper to suckle on because he's beyond knowing the difference. No, not even when the rest of your children grow fed up with your black garments, your secret tears, your headaches when you smell cucumber. You do not die. I guess I tried to address the isolation survivors feel, because one thing that trauma does is disconnect you from your community, even your own children who have also been through it. The gas survivor, and many of the gas survivors now suffer from long-term chronic illness, and some of them died of cancer. This particular woman is suffering from womb cancer. My body is blooming. Every night, leaking flowers, I turn my mattress into a bed of roses. Black, cherry red, pink, and gold. By day, I hand wash the towels, recall the stillborn after the gassing. Who would have thought that there were weapons that turn every part of your body against you? Every bruise, cough, or a nosebleed seeming like the final betrayal. Weapons that turn you into a despised being in your own village, no one daring to visit you, thinking you are contagious. Weapons that kill you years after being exposed, leaving you unable to blame anyone for your death. One thing that survivors talk about a lot is the search for closure, because many of their loved ones are buried in mass graves in the south and west of Iraq, and because of security reasons and because of financial issues, these graves are not uncovered. And many of them say they harbor hope still because they don't have a body to bury, and how important it is to bury your loved one and be sure and move on. So this is two women fighting over the body, the remains of a 14-year-old boy. Dispute over a mass grave. The one you have finished examining is my son. That is the milky-colored Kurdish suit his father tailored for him, the blue shirt his uncle gave to him. Your findings prove that it is him. He was a tall 14-year-old, was left-handed, had broken a rib. I know she too has been looking for her son, but you have to tell her that this is not him. Yes, the two of them were playmates and fought the year before, but it was my son who broke a rib. Hers only feigned to escape trouble. That one is mine. Please give him back to me. I will bury him on the verge of my garden. The mulberry tree will offer him its shadow. The flowers will earnestly guard his grave. The hens will peck on his gravestone, and the beehive will hum above his head. I'll read one more survivor story before the end of the sequence. And I met many survivors who were very angry for obvious reasons, but also for reasons of being exploited by people who interview them all the time. Every year for commemoration, the journalists go and see them and interview them, and other people go and see them. And this woman didn't want to speak with me, and this is her story. The angry survivor. I am fed up with documentations of my grief. Journalists asking me to sing a lullaby for my dead children to broadcast during commemorations. Government officials using my story as propaganda during elections. Women activists forcing me to talk about rape only to prove that women are oppressed. Researchers claiming to record history when all they do is pick my wounds. This is my story, not yours. Long after you turn off your recorder, I stay indoors and weep. Why don't people understand? I am neither hero nor God, cannot stand the talk of forgiveness. For years, I went to every wake, wept at every man's funeral, kept asking why, realized I will never understand. Now, I just endure the days by planting cucumbers, which you interrupted, by believing in another world where there will be justice. by watching my remaining children as they sleep. Spare me your despair and understanding. You cannot resurrect the dead, feed my hungry children, bring me recognition and respect. Take history with you and go. Don't come here again. I don't want to know. Final poem in the sequence, Researcher's Blues. Every day I try to lose them in the streets, leave them behind in a bend in the road and keep on walking. But they follow me everywhere, their voices combining into a hum from which sentences rise and fall. The woman I never interviewed cut the string of my sleep at dawn, whispering, "I'm not well." Why didn't I listen to her story? Why didn't I realize that she was dying? The one widowed at 26 told me, "Imagine 20 years of loneliness." I remember her in the middle of an embrace and start weeping. The pleading voice of the woman who was raped echoes in my head. I only wanted bread for my son. I wish I had told her that she is good, she's pure, not spoiled as she thinks she is. Then I remember the old couple in their mud brick house, surrounded by goats and chicken. I remember their tears when they talk about their children, when they remember a woman who had been wealthy and powerful in her own village, but in Nugra Salman, she was stinking, abandoned, womb-stricken. What was the dead woman's name? Why didn't I try to find her family? I keep walking away. All I want is to walk without crying, without being pitied by people who think that I have trouble with love, without the homeless man telling me that he is sorry. I want to disappear, be unnoticed, unpitied. Some time ago, when it all started, it was all clear. I knew what had to be done. All I can do now is keep walking, carrying this sorrow in my soul. All I can do is pour with grief, which has no beginning and no end. Now, because there are awful things happening all around us all the time, and because we need to look after ourselves, I believe we have to continue loving and being well and having a sense of humor. So I want to change the tone completely and go to this poem, which is a joke. It's called The Seventh Wedding Invitation. Now, when I was a little girl, my daughter's age, quite a few people, when I said something funny or acted cheekily, everybody would say, "You would be married seven times." This is what we say to young kids, young girls in Kurdish, meaning that it's a curse, basically. Nobody will be able to put up with you. I personally think it's a very good thing, because if you manage to convince seven people to marry you, you must be special. I am on my third, so I don't think I've done badly. The Seventh Wedding Invitation. Dear friends and family, I promise this will be my last wedding. If it doesn't work out, I'll just live with another man, no more pledges. So please come along to this final ceremony with a man who, at the moment, fills my eyes. Do not bring any more presents, please. Pura Shahla's non-stick pan is still in the box. Mama Hama's gold ring has not been put on, and the naughty lingerie will be worn for this man since my ex was orthodox. He didn't last long. Do come along. I promise to wear something more sophisticated than a wedding dress. It's another chance to meet and talk about Amma's failure in bringing up her children, to shed light one more time on Leila's divorce and Nina's remarriage to her brother-in-law. We will have a fun night. I have told my new man so much about you, and to be sure, it may be your only chance to meet him. With all my love, your little Lala. Going with the theme of love, since we know each other better, This poem, Summer Roof, is probably my first love. I don't know. When I was like 5 or 6, I fancied a 20-year-old neighbor who got married and I was cursing his wife, but probably that doesn't count, right? So Summer Roof is, if you know, you've probably seen this in the Middle East, we have flat roofs, and in the summer it gets very hot, so you sleep on the roof. And this was very convenient for me that summer because I was in love with a young man across the road, and I watched him smoke over the opposite roof for the whole summer, without speaking, of course. And I guess it's another example of when there is war and conflict, all of our memories and stories are contaminated by war, and this is another example. Every night that summer, when we went to bed on the flat roof, I stayed awake, watching the opposite roof where he was, a tiny light turning on every time he puffed his cigarette. Once I was shown his paintings, and I went home and wrote his name all over my books. I kept imagining what he would say, how I would respond. I imagined being married to him, looking after him when he fell ill, cooking for him and washing his hair. I imagined sleeping on the same roof. A whole year went by and we never talked. Then suddenly, an empty house opposite us, an empty roof, not staring back, and sleepless nights for me. Years later, we met again, the same man with a few fingers missing, bad-tempered, not able to paint. We never spoke. We remained on our separate roofs. I'll end with a very short poem, His Boots, and it's about Saddam Hussein's boots. Now, as I was growing up, he was always wearing military clothing. There was the war with Iran, there was the invasion of Kuwait, there was the war with America, there was the continuous war against the Kurds, you know, enemies were endless. So I just imagined 2003, when in that period when he went into hiding, I imagined that moment where this dictator that everybody was terrified of becomes an old man on the run, and he's scared like the rest of us. And I tried a little bit to humanize him. His boots. The old woman will always keep those boots. On the day when things were ending, she was leaning on her stick in disbelief when a car with black windows slowed down. She watched the back window open fast, and there he was, the dictator, suddenly looking old and frail, dropping his military boots and replacing them with old men's shoes. Then the window closed and the car took off, leaving dust on the pair of boots, still warm and moist from his feet. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Toman. And now please welcome Andre Nafis-Saheli.
Thank you, Margaret, and it's a pleasure to read with both James and Choman, and thank you all for coming. I even though I'm of mixed parentage, I find the easiest thing to say about my background, really, and this is by way of introduction, is that I'm from Abu Dhabi. As in, I like to think of myself as specifically from a city rather than from a country. And the reason for that is also because Abu Dhabi is not really a real city. It's not really a real capital, and it's not really in a real country. In fact, the whole time I grew up there, as soon as I'd started reading newspapers, I would always notice the words phenomenon and boom and miracle associated with Abu Dhabi, hardly ever the word city or conurbation, the normal words you'd attach to these places. And this poem is called Disposable Cities. And I think it's a means of addressing the origin myth, let's say, of Abu Dhabi. Disposable cities. They begin as blips on the horizon of prospects, rumors, snippets of exaggerated talk, too fabulous to believe, but too alluring to forget. Something has been found. Gold, silver, uranium, coltan, or oil. Before long, the prospect of immeasurable wealth drowns all incredulity. The migration begins. The engineers in their hard hats and linens are the first on the ground, and with them come derricks, drills, platforms, and dry docks. Pipelines sink their tentacles into every lucrative crevice on the map. The maps are kept secret. A handful of shacks are erected to provide a few basic services. Soon enough, the handful swells into a hamlet, then a village, and finally a city. Such cities are the perfect sort of settlement for the modern world. Everything is shipped in, everything is easily assembled. Their primary and overriding purpose is to extract, process, and distribute. Just like a motorized pump draws water out of a well, they start inhaling people from all over the world, one desperado at a time. At first, these fresh arrivals find their new homes unsettling. They find it difficult to adjust to the weird climates and are frazzled by the confusion of languages. No one is under any illusions. They are ephemeral guests, non-citizens. Belonging is a dream best forgotten or deferred. Most have come empty-handed, having traded their old lives for grubstakes. Lots of money slushes around, but most of it is spent simply surviving. And when it runs out, people watch their lives fall apart. Everyone exists in a heightened state of awareness. One's false move and they're gone. The poorer they are, the more modest their gambles, which will more often than not make them poorer. Beggars don't build homelands, they tell themselves, fantasizing about the day when they might return home and become somebody. The myth, meanwhile, has traveled to the four corners of the planet. More than cities, these Eldorados are a state of mind, places where people come to reinvent themselves and realize their most eccentric fantasies. All cities live out their lot and die, but disposable cities are special. They thrive in areas of the world generally deemed inhospitable or uninhabitable, in Greenland, Siberia, the Amazon, the Yukon, or the empty quarter. They are mushrooms of greed, requiring no loving care or attention. They simply erupt and flourish. Yet their fame is fleeting. Once they're bled dry, these cities' roads go raw with potholes. Chickens roam loose in the opera houses. Power lines sag, and rot seeps in, tarring all in sight. Only those unlucky enough not to make it stay in town for the decline. One day, the wind howls, and the last tent comes undone. The lie has moved on to the next disposable city. When I was a child, my mother used to tell me that lies had short legs and thus could not get very far. Somebody lied to her. I remember scribbling something down very quickly, because I had to, while Choman was reading one of her poems, and it was because she had said that it is very important to be able to bury a body. And I realized that that was really a far better, perhaps, encapsulated sentiment that this poem was trying to express. The United Arab Emirates is composed of about 10 million people right now, and 86% of the population are foreigners. People can live there for 20 to 30 years and still have to renew their visas once a year. And they, for the most part, depending on their racial category, are basically beholden to their employer. Although the UAE has made a name for itself as a destination where you can have five-star holidays for three-star prices, the reality is that what it enforces in a very informal way is a slightly modified version of the apartheid system that reigned in South Africa for a lot of the 20th century. Different ethnicities are a lot of different jobs. And even though the UAE was built by millions of these people over the course of the past 30, 35 years, none of them have been allowed to be buried there, even when they died there. And they died there like flies, because when you're working in 50-degree heat, that's what happens. For the most part, heart attacks, but then also the fact that people are denied health care there makes it worse, inevitably. So this poem is called Vanishing Act. Only 2 out of 10 people die in Abu Dhabi. The rest simply fail to have their visas renewed. They are bagged, tagged and placed on the next available flight back to wherever they first came from. The one-way ticket experience par excellence. Every edifice on this island is crafted by these almost nothings. In death, at least, there is solace. Never again to queue for days on end. Never again to have their fingertips inked and pressed by intolerant hands. Their blood screened for undesirable illnesses. Their flesh seared by a sun that wonders what the hell they're doing there. I have to backtrack a little. The male children of expatriates, if that's the right word, which it isn't, for the 86% of people who live in the UAE, are obliged to leave the country once they turn 18, and that is universally enforced. Female children, however, are not forced to leave, and part of the reason for that is actually quite a twisted use of scriptures in the Quran, where the situation being, of course, that parents are not willing to let their daughters out of their sight before they've been safely married off, and so there is that exemption. But I think this poem was tries to capture the moment when I was a teenager and I realized that in a very short amount of time I would have to leave, for good, really. And it's called An Island of Strangers. The reason island crops up a lot is because Abu Dhabi, like Venice, where I was actually born, is an island. So, An Island of Strangers. The rooftop was the place to be. I was 15 and in love with ash cans, pigeon coops, women hanging their laundry. There was a 50-foot portrait of the king by the sea, overlooking a busy junction, always smiling, like an ad for toothpaste or mouthwash. At night, the shore on the west side of town was the quietest, where hotels, Natasha's, and haram coalesced into parties. Every half-lit room was a sure sign of orgasms and the passing of money from stranger to stranger. Anything interesting or pleasurable was haram. I envied the king and his sons, all 18 of them. The king was virile, a patriarch, Abraham on Viagra. His people, on the other hand, were on Prozac. Everywhere the eye looked was money. The nose hit only sweat, acrid, pugnacious, pervasive. Most of the boys I knew sucked butane, smoked, saved up for prostitutes, waited for their parole in the summer, each back to his own country. Come September, to the satisfied return. Misfit mutts, at home everywhere and nowhere. A friend compared cosmopolitanism to being stuck at summer camp, to waiting for parents who never showed up. In the 33rd year of his smile, the king finally died. His mausoleum is a meringue, wavy, white, and empty. His sons have gotten on squabbling, playing who's his biggest with bricks. One by one, they die in car crashes, days of heat strokes, kiff, and bloodthirsty Ferraris. The dying princes here, actually, that's reported fact. I like inserting facts into poems. One of the king's youngest sons died because he refused to take helicopter lessons once he was given a helicopter for his 18th birthday, and that's why he perished. Some of the others died of alcoholism, sexually transmitted illnesses, the various shebang, which is strange considering that they rule over a theocracy. So I guess they don't really live by their own messages. But I think, sorry, let me just turn to the right page here. I left the UAE when I was 18, and although I'm aware that I really don't sound like it, I spent 11 years here. So I left Abu Dhabi and I came to the UK. And I lived in the Midlands and in Scotland and in London. And left about 11 years later, but we'll get to that in a minute. And even though I was technically allowed to return to the UAE, it became very difficult once I started writing because they do keep track of who writes what about them. And the reason for that is very simple. They spend millions of pounds on PR and advertising. Right now, I think the reason why I stumbled a bit with the last poem I read was because what I kept thinking about was that the princes I was talking about are the same princes that spend all their time on pleasure yachts with people like Prince Andrew while they're transacting deals for, I think it was last year, £3 billion worth of bombs, which they've been dropping on Yemen. But When I said that everything was imported and shipped into the Emirates, I really meant that, because the bombs that the Emiratis are now currently dropping on the Yemenis are being flown in planes purchased from Britain, with bombs purchased from Britain. And I'm told that the pilots currently flying those planes, because the UAE Army has no such certified pilots, are also on loan. So that must be the first ever bombing of one country by another, where literally every part of it is either sponsored or performed by another. But to get back to the return, I only returned a few times in the 11 years I was here in the UK to the UAE. And this poem is about one of those visits, called The Return. I get stamped in like a tourist. It's 7 a.m. and my father's waiting for me at arrivals. We drive along the impossibly wide highways over the bridge to the island of Abu Dhabi. 60 years ago, there was almost nothing here, a single mud brick fort where the ruler and his family lived, a few brackish wells, an airstrip, and a handful of huts. Now it accommodates 1.5 million people from just about anywhere on Earth and hosts a Formula One Grand Prix. My father pulls up in a parking lot in the middle of Batin, a residential neighborhood. On entering the three-story building where he and my mother live, I spot a succession of bright red crosses spray-painted on nearly every wall, door, and hallway. It's like Passover at King Herod's. My father explains that an official from the municipality has inspected the building last week and ordered all the partitions turned down in accordance with new planning regulations. Most of the building is held up by light interior walls that sound like ripe watermelons when you wrap your knuckles against them. The municipality has given my parents 2 days to knock down the walls, or they'll cut off their gas, water, and electricity. Over the years, my family has acquired a breathtaking proficiency in paring down their lives to the bare essentials. Living in the UAE is like assembling a Jenga tower, then nervously trying to remove as many blocks as you can without the entire edifice collapsing on you. Once the wall is gone, my parents will get a reprieve from the city authorities, like the rest of their anxious fellow tenants, at which point the game starts all over again. So as I was briefly mentioning earlier, I moved to America towards the end of 2014, purely to be with the woman I later married, because she was American, is American. And this is a poem I wrote for her when I first moved there to be with her. We were living in upstate New York in the Catskill Mountains. So the poem is called In the Catskills. I'm not very good at titles. In the Catskills, for Zinzi. We were trapped in a town called Liberty. Our cabin lay on top of a hill where the snow kept us caged for entire weeks at a time. Down the dirt road, past a couple of bends, lay the hamlet of Neversink, which of course had been drowned by a reservoir. It was hard to think of anything human around us as serious. All man had built reeked of failure and rust. We lived amidst the ruined remnants of a Yankee frontier town, slumbering mills, silent railroads, idle factories, gutted houses, a few drowsy strip malls. It was the nonsensical heart of angry America, where descendants of unionists proudly flew Dixie flags despite the dark man in the White House. The one half-decent bite to eat was at Stew's, a blue Cullman diner formerly on 49th and 11th that got pushed out by franchises and then exiled upstate on a flatbed, never to return. When the mulch plant shut down, the sons and daughters of Liberty debated at length the great prospects before them, casinos or fracking. But the rich second homeowners fought the oil men and won. So casinos it was. Liberty, son, an old school teacher told me, is where the past comes to die. Ain't it funny to think, my beloved, that this was where our future began? America's proved depressingly inspiring. And it really hasn't abated since I moved there, for obvious reasons that I don't need to get into. We all know the score, I think. I'm probably going to probably going to end with this one, I think, because... and I think I don't really think it expires much of an explanation. People have called it my Trump is coming poem that I felt sometime around 2015. Not that that was really that prescient, but here we go. In the shadow of Monadnock, the bronze Union soldier stands guard on the green. Behind him, the town hall where his forefathers voted to live free or die is for sale. The Republic slides to insolvency, and the few yes we can stickers still left in the windows are beginning to bleach. Spring loosens its hold on the rivers. The rich smell of rot wafts out from the leaves. Something moves in the shadowy pines that sway in the strong winds and creak like rusty doors in a horror film. A fast hammering can be heard. Those woodpeckers know which tree is next to die. I sit on the sagging porch of Joe's Red Colonial and watch the last ribbons of paint peel away from the shingles. There are 5 bedrooms inside, but only one is kept warm. No TV or radio either. The news upsets Walter. Joe's girls left long ago, off to plow the hard field of the city. The milk cow that saw them to adulthood died last year. New money is spreading like moss, while the locals are losing their homes. It was easier once, she said. You were born, you worked the land, and then the land worked you back into it. Now the grocery bags grow thinner and thinner. Joe means to stick it out. Birds whose names elude us shatter the silence in a good way, maybe the best. I inhale the crisp New England air and exhale a panegyric. Joe smiles, tells me that quite a few of the folk up here are suffering from asthma. They can thank Pennsylvania for that, she says. It's the dust carried north from the coal mines on the breeze. There's hatred, envy, and greed afoot in our world, wrote an old Saxon poet, and this is where you must live, among the thieves and the killers. Back in the square, I stare into the dead coins of the soldiers' eyes and can almost hear their trumpets. There's nowhere to run. Thank you.